This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, October 28th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. In just a moment, a conversation with Fort Smith Mayor Sandy Sanders about yesterday's announcement that Whirlpool will be closing its plant in Fort Smith. Then Jacqueline Froelich reports on last night's visit to Springdale by GOP presidential candidate Herman Cain.
And one programming note, a story that we promoted during Morning Edition this morning, our story about the Star Shopper, a business landmark in Northwest Arkansas for nearly 40 years, will not be heard today, but don't worry, that will air on our Monday program.
The Friends of Washington Regional Hospice are hosting their 25th annual Autumn Brunch next Wednesday, November 2nd, from 11 to 1 in recognition of Pat Walker. This fundraising event will include a seasonal buffet and beverages, live entertainment, and door prizes. Tickets and more information are available by calling 444-9888 or on the web at wregional.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Yesterday, Whirlpool announced it would close its Fort Smith plant, a business staple in the city for more than four decades. The shuttering means the loss of at least 1,000 jobs and comes in the wake of what Whirlpool officials say is a shrinking market for certain appliances and a slumping economy. With me on the phone is Fort Smith Mayor Sandy Sanders. Mayor, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kyle.
You've had less than a day as we speak to digest this news. I'm sure there have been discussions and considerations about what a city and a city administration can do in reaction to such news.
Yes, obviously it was a sad day. It's a disheartening time. But at this point, with the decision made, we've just got to focus on moving forward. Manufacturing has always been a staple in Fort Smith, and it continues to be. But I think this just kind of points out that we need to, really work forward on developing a broader base of employment opportunities. And I think we can do that. We have a very good working relationship with the Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the Fort Smith Regional Chamber of Commerce. And I'm confident we will just redouble our efforts to grow new businesses, to help existing businesses expand and provide jobs for these folks.
As you mentioned, manufacturing has long been a strong part of the Fort Smith region economy, but the loss of manufacturing jobs has not just been limited to this part of the country. I know that the city has been looking at expanding the economic base for some time, not just since yesterday, right?
Right. And, with the declining employment, not just at Whirlpool, but at some other businesses over the past few years, when you really look at the employment rate, we have been able to do a very good job of absorbing those losses into existing jobs as other organizations have grown and developed. This morning, we had a brand new opening of Dick's Sporting Goods here in Fort Smith with 90 jobs there. Golden Living is adding a couple of hundred people to their billing operations. Next year, Mitsubishi is scheduled to begin production, and they will have about 300 and some people working there. So over the past few years, even though some of our manufacturing jobs have been lost, those jobs have been absorbed into the labor market, and our unemployment level had continued to be below the national level. So I think that Fort Smith continues to be vibrant and offer some good opportunities. We just need to refocus on our efforts right now on trying to absorb these recent cuts now.
Have there been any conversations with Whirlpool about trying to find a buyer for that plant?
A little premature, but that is one of the things that they have indicated they want to do is work with the city, work with the state to do whatever Whirlpool can to help find a tenant, an operator, an owner of the facility. It's a very large building, 1,200,000 square feet, an adjacent distribution center of over 700,000 square feet. So it's a large facility, and these days there are not that many companies looking for buildings of that magnitude. So it may take a while if we were looking for just one person, but other companies, and Whirlpool in particular, in another location, have found the opportunity to market the facility and break it up inside into a variety of individual companies that don't need the full 1,200,000 square feet, for example, but could use 50, 60, 100,000 and have a variety of people in there.
I know Whirlpool officials will talk with the people that are employed there still, and I guess the closing doesn't happen until mid-next year, about severance pay and things. Is there a thing a city can do when there is this kind of loss of jobs to help the people that will be affected?
Well, there's the city is really limited on some of those kinds of things, other than working very closely to try and get new jobs in here. And we will do everything we can to surface candidates, to surface potential businesses, to bring those folks in. And I think that one of the things we really have to offer is the quality of the people that will work here. The people at Whirlpool did everything possible to make it feasible for the plant to remain open. It's the most efficient plant within Whirlpool. It has great flexibility. The quality of its products are outstanding. And I think that's what's kind of more disappointing than anything, is that everybody here did everything feasible to keep operating. From the line operators to local management, everybody worked very hard and did everything they could, and yet still wound up in the face of declining demand for the product line that's built here.
And finally, there is a personal connection for you with this story as well, isn't there?
Yes, I worked at Whirlpool for 32 years and still know a lot of the folks there. Yesterday was very painful personally and as mayor. Very concerned about the people that are there and how they're going to personally be affected, and with their families being impacted. But again, we've got such great people that have worked there and continue to work there that I'm confident that things are going to work out long term. It's not good right now, absolutely not good. But I think that all the folks there they're going to continue to do the best they can, and everyone's going to pitch in, and we'll do whatever we can to keep those folks here and get them jobs keep them part of the local economy.
Mayor Sanders, thank you so much for your time.
Kyle, thank you very much, and appreciate everyone's prayers and support.
Presidential candidate Herman Cain made an appearance in Northwest Arkansas at the 15th annual Washington County Republican Committee's Lincoln Day Dinner at the Holiday Inn Convention Center in Springdale, where he gave the keynote speech. Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Nearly 1,500 Republicans from a five-state region paid as much as $100 a plate to eat grilled balsamic chicken with red, white, and blue salad, and to see the fresh political phenomenon known as Herman Cain.
I was commenting to the people at my table that I feel right at home here because of the warm reception that I have received, not only this trip, but every trip that I've made through Arkansas. You all understand Southern hospitality, and I do appreciate it.
Georgia native and former president and CEO of Godfather's Pizza is seeking the office of President of the United States. His speech was plain. He used no notes, and he charged no fees to appear at this local political fundraiser where he hoped to rouse support.
And I believe that we will take back the American dream, which has been hijacked by the liberals in this country, because of that spirit of America that has awakened.
Referring to neoconstitutionalists who manifest the Tea Party movement several years ago, Cain's currently a top pick among Tea Party Republicans. In a recent CBS New York Times poll of registered voters, Republican voters released earlier this week, found Cain leading the full GOP pack of contenders by 25%, with Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney at 21%, followed by Newt Gingrich at 10%, and Ron Paul and Rick Perry in the single digits. The poll's margin of error is plus or minus 4%. For Cain, that's a rise of 20 points since early September. And wherever he campaigns, crowds follow, including yesterday evening in Springdale. Several dozen opponents also showed up to protest outside in the cold drizzle. Inside, Cain spoke of America being the envy of the world, despite its sputtering economic machine, and how Americans are able to meet challenges.
And I believe that this nation, the people of this nation, are itching and hungry for some significant change because of the direction that we are going in right now.
Republicans of all stripes are bent on taking over the White House and U.S. Senate in 2012. But over and over, Herman Cain told the crowd he was not a politician. Rather, he was a businessman who knows how to fix things.
Working on the right problem. That's one of the things that distinguishes me from some of the other contenders for the Republican nomination. This economy is on life support. And we know it is on life support. Because there is a fundamental economic principle that this administration does not get. And that is, the economic engine of this economy is the business sector, not government. But this is why we have the mess that we have. This president and his administration are determined to do it their way, which is the wrong way. And this is why in 2012, you and I are going to tell this president to hit the highway.
Standing in front of a huge American flag, Kaine spoke of his Navy career as a ballistics analyst, creating strategic weaponry, which led to his becoming a strategic and successful businessman, which he said will lead him to become our nation's leader. From a President Herman Kaine, we can expect a repeal of health care reform, as he calls it, the gutting of environmental laws to pursue domestic energy, zero tolerance immigration enforcement, reducing federal entitlements, leaving it to states and cities and charities to tend to the poor, the death of financial reform embodied in the Dodd-Frank bill, allowing free markets to reign, and finally, a new federal flat tax formula based on the now famous nines.
That starts with, throw out the current tax code. We should have thrown it out a long time ago. And then replace it with a plan that we have called 999. 9% business flat tax, 9% personal income flat tax, and a 9% national sales tax.
The result, he said, would expand the gross domestic product by $2 trillion, create 6 million new jobs, increase business investment by one-third, and increase wages by 10%. Kaine says it's fair, neutral, and transparent. Kaine's 999 plan would end nearly all deductions and feature zero tax on capital gains and would kill the death tax. Plus, he says it would save the nation $430 billion in tax code compliance costs. Critics say more than three-quarters of single individuals and working poor families would end up paying more and, in the end, corporations less. As for international and especially military affairs, Kaine said he has no experience, so will rely on White House experts to advise. He said presidential candidate Barack Obama had no such expertise either. In fact, U.S. Senator Barack Obama served on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and traveled widely to Eastern Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Social issues are top Republican interests, but Kaine did not speak of these. Recently, he confused his followers by insisting he was against abortion, yet said families ultimately have the right to choose. He since clarified that position on his homepage, writing he's 100% pro-life. Several times, Kaine described how, as a rising presidential candidate, he now wears a target on his back. He blamed the media numerous times for disinformation and warned Republicans to ignore negative reports and look only at his rising polling numbers.
The voice of the people is more powerful than the voice of the media.
Kaine also spoke about money, how his campaign's operating on very little of it, yet succeeding.
Message is more important than money. Yes, money is important, but message is more powerful than money.
He pointed out that, yes, Mitt Romney has $15 million, Rick Perry has raised $17 million, and Ron Paul's collected $8.2 million, and that he's managed to raise only $2.8 million. Yet he continues to escalate above his opponents with a shoestring staff and no political machine. In the audience listening were former U.S. Congressman John Paul Hammerschmidt, as well as U.S. Senator John Bozeman and U.S. Congressman Steve Womack. Northwest Arkansas in the 3rd Congressional District, a Republican stronghold that saw the rout of Democratic U.S. Senator Blanche Lincoln in 2010, the second time since Reconstruction. Still, we have a Democratic governor with a high approval rating and a majority Democratic General Assembly Democrats also control more statewide and local offices, but Republicans are taking over constitutional offices. Lieutenant Governor Mark Dar, Secretary of State Mark Martin, and Republican Land Commissioner John Thurston, as pointed out during the fundraising dinner, just one more will make for a GOP majority in Arkansas. And Herman Cain, an arch Republican, who is also a motivational author and speaker, in closing, talked about how surviving liver cancer and the birth of his granddaughter eventually pushed him towards politics as a means to give back to his family and his nation.
I am convinced that I am where I am today because this is God's plan for me.
At the end of his talk, Cain provided three suggestions for moving forward. Stay informed, stay inspired, get involved, and stay involved.
I came from a very humble family. My mother was a domestic worker. My father was a barber, a janitor, and a chauffeur, all at the same time. They never talked about us being the victims in our household. Dad never talked about somebody owes us something. They taught us to believe in God, believe in yourself, and believe in the greatest country in the world where you can achieve your dreams.
This weekend, presidential hopeful Herman Cain will tour Alabama. Then on Monday, we'll speak at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. By the way, his campaign motto, let's get real. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
All proceeds from the annual Washington County Republican Committee's Lincoln Day Dinner go to fund party candidates in Washington County for statewide or local office. Last year, that totaled more than $30,000.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
Sharing stories, ghost stories, urban legends, murderous historical facts is one of the best parts of the Halloween season. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda recently explored the history of an old Benton County cave and has this story.
Just north of Gravette, along Highway 59, the sounds of cars flying by echo through the valley. On Paul and Tracy Lynn Scott's property, it doesn't take long to escape the noise. A few steps off the road, there's a black plastic curtain covering a hole on the side of a hill. After unlocking a metal gate and stepping into the passageway, the world goes quiet inside their cave.
So you're kind of seeing this from, we have a side entrance that we actually take people into.
Okay, so this is the easy, when we do like regular tours, this is actually the entry zone. When we're doing Halloween, this is actually our exit zone, so.
So it's a little different.
The Lynn Scotts are the owners of the old Spanish treasure cave, which becomes the haunted Spanish treasure cavern each year during the Halloween season. Also during the month of October, guests can explore the Trail of Terror, which goes through a portion of the woods on the property. A love of the spooky holiday is one thing the recently married couple shares.
We both love Halloween, and that's one of the things that we really share in common with. I was doing it a long time ago, and it just thought, what a fantastic place. Could you walk into a cave, and you're already underground. So for a lot of people, that's a little bit scary. It's a little unnerving, especially when we add what we add to it.
Paul has more than 35 years of caving experience. He says he wanted to buy a place with a cave, and he's been living at his current home for more than 15 years. The cave itself has an interesting history, which dates back a few centuries.
It was about 350, 400 years ago, the Spanish conquistadors were making their way from Spain up through old Mexico, and they made it as far as Arkansas. On their way, they were robbing and looting the Aztecs and the Mayans, and then when they made it up into the states here, they were raiding Indian settlements. Well, they got up here in a brutal winter storm, and their carts were breaking down, their horses were dying off, and they found this cavern. The unique thing about this cavern is there's actually a chimney that goes all the way up. So they were able to go in there, they were able to cook, you know, and stay alive. And But the last Indian settlement that they robbed, the Braves were gone, and it was just all women and children. So when the Braves got back, they found their encampment completely destroyed. So they started tracking these Spaniards down. And that's how they caught them, because they saw the smoke rising into the sky from the hill. And we know that all but one, at least one of the Spanish conquistadors survived, because it's documented history. And he went through and hid the treasure and then closed all the openings to the cave and made his way back to Old Spain.
How did you find out about the history of the cave?
Well, the documents have actually been found. So the cavern was sealed up and lost until about 1885. And that's when a descendant, an old man from Madrid, Spain, came over and hired some young men to look for a hoof imprint or a horseshoe imprint carved in a bluff. Well, that's when they found that out here. They dug underneath it, removed a huge boulder, and that's when they first rediscovered the cavern back in 1885. And that's when the first treasure hunt took place as well.
Did they ever find the treasure?
No, the treasure has not been found. Lots of artifacts have been found, but the treasure still has eluded us.
Paul explains a lot of past owners bought the cave thinking they could simply dig around and find the treasure. But they eventually discovered that wasn't the case. He says it's a very complex cave system. It's very maze-like, with passages and tunnels everywhere. So the question is, as the current owners, do Paul and Tracy ever search for the treasure?
Oh, sure.
Absolutely. If you had a treasure in your backyard, wouldn't you go search for it?
During the Halloween season, friends and local high school students help run the scary attractions. But the cave does see visitors during other parts of the year. March through September, guests can stop by for regular tours of the cave. In December, the cave is decorated with lights and traditional Christmas scenes. The couple also offer special tours that include spending the night in the cave.
We do have a special program for Boy Scout groups and youth groups, and it's a Camp in the Cave program where we actually take these kids camping inside, teach them about caves, teach them about the proper techniques of caving and the rules, regulations, and the good points and everything about caves. And, of course, they get to go wild caving, and they get to spend the night inside there. So that's a very exciting, very popular program.
Although they do decorate the cave, Paul says it's important to keep it as natural as possible for the sake of the cavern's ecology. Paul says caves are fascinating places, and as you explore them, you will notice different things each time.
Caves, once you step inside, you're completely secluded from the outside world. And it's just a real peaceful, real calming effect. You know, really the only noise you hear is maybe a little dripping water and sometimes a little wind and whatever noise y'all make. So
it's very beautiful. Like Paul said, our cave is a very mazy cave. So instead of it being a linear cave where you just walk in and keep going, we have three different levels in our cave. We have a entire bottom level. We have a middle level that we take our tours on. And then we have an upper level. And so we've gone caving many a times, and it never ceases to amaze me at the beauty of the cave. So if you can, you know, open your mind, you can see so much. It's so beautiful. It's so peaceful.
Tracy says they do see a number of repeat customers. Frequent visitors are familiar with the couple's dog, Sam. They often bring the large mixed breed pup his favorite snack, tater tots, from Sonic. Tracy says that unlike Paul, she is new to the world of caving. She says it may sound silly, but when she first entered the cave, it took her breath away, and you just knew you fit.
Yeah, we love it. Like I said, you just kind of walk in and just kind of, I don't know, first time I ever walked in, it was just, it felt like home, you know, very comfortable, very.
Mm-hmm.
One of my biggest things is when I do get kids in here that are so scared of bats, and to see them when they walk out, the joy on their face because they walked in so scared. And they left with a big smile on their face. That's just...
It's mostly the fear of the unknown.
Yep.
So when they look at the bats and everything, and they find out, oh, these things aren't going to attack us and bite us, and we're not going to turn into vampires
or big bears are going to run out and chase you and stuff. It's very rewarding because you know that you've changed their thought process on something. So. Mm-hmm.
The haunted attractions at the Old Spanish Treasure Cave are open through Halloween. Admission is $12 for the cave, $8 for the trail, or $18 for both. The owners say the haunted cave attraction is recommended for those 12 and older because there are no chicken exits. Once you're in the cave, you're in until the end of the attraction. More information is available at Spanish-treasure-cave.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Katie Henriksen.
And with us in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Stephen Bias, the conductor, music director of the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Ready to start what they would say in the sports world is the sophomore season.
Yes, indeed. It's my second year as the music director of the Arkansas Philharmonic, and I'd like to say that it's a special concert to kick off the season, but truly it's like every other concert, a lot of dynamic music, a world-class soloist, and some great feature for the members of the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra.
It's the three Bs.
The three Bs. You know, the traditional three Bs, Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, I think earned that nomer because that was the composer that most people know. You ask them three Bs, and there you go. There's so many great composers whose name begins with B, and I thought, well, we have Beethoven on the concert. We have Berlioz, Bruck, and Beethoven. Beethoven is the anchor to the original Titanic three, but we'll call Beethoven the king bee for this concert. But with Berlioz and Bruck, we have a feature for the orchestra and perhaps one of the most perfect concerti that have ever been written for a solo instrument.
So how do you – when you have these – some bees, some of the bees, I've asked you this before, put the program together. How do you do that?
Well, I'm always fascinated, and I love the process of a program, and I'm fascinated by the puzzle-like manner that a program comes together. I start with the concerto, or if we're featuring a soloist or a chorus, whatever is the central part of the program, I build around. And in this case, Natasha Korsakova, our phenomenal violin soloist, suggested several things. We worked together last year, and she played Bruch, and it was absolutely sublime. So I asked if she would perform it again, and she was enthusiastic about it. So in trying to form a program around the Bruch Violin Concerto No. 1 in G minor, I wanted to have something to open the program that is rousing, and the Berlioz Roman Carnival Overture is a genuine orchestral showpiece. And the Beethoven Symphony No. 5, perhaps the most recognizable and famous piece of classical music ever written. The very first piece, the Berlioz Roman Carnival, is ironic that the music is taken from an opera that was a relative flop, Benvenuto Cellini. And the overture, however, when Berlioz kind of recovered and licked his wounds from the flop of the opera, the overture has always enjoyed great popularity and enjoyment with audiences. It begins with carnival music, a very short introduction, and it's followed by the English horn playing a love theme from the opera. And the viola section, the cello section, in turn take this beautiful love melody. And we return to the carnival music, which builds to a glorious finish, but not before Berlioz stops everything and inserts a fugue at the end. So it's cheeky in some ways, but it features the entire orchestra, a very bravura opening in this gorgeous section with the English horn and the strings, but then the entire orchestra in one fashion is featured in this showpiece. A great way to open a concert, I believe, especially at the beginning of the year. And the Bruch, I feel that it's a perfect concerto, but the balance of this piece is remarkable. I think that Bruch couldn't help but write good music. He was one of those melodists like Schubert or Mozart where it was just natural, intrinsic for him to write music that was very easy to listen to.
You wanted to ask about the guest artist, the violinist.
Well, I just read that she is related to Rimsky-Korsakov.
That's right. Natasha is the great-grandniece of Russian composer Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov. And there must be something genetic because she has a certain fiery aspect to her playing. But this subtlety. Now, it's a really interesting thing because the greatest orchestrator of his day was Rimsky-Korsakov. Stravinsky studied with Rimsky-Korsakov and proclaimed that his great skill when he wrote The Firebird, his first major piece, was in fact due to the study with Rimsky-Korsakov. So it's all about subtleties, and certainly Natasha in her playing has a range of subtleties which is just wonderful. But in addition to being a great violinist, she has, I guess, a side career as a model for Laura Biagiotti's fashion line, and she has a lot of interest in every direction. I really love Natasha as a violinist, but as a person, she's a genuinely interesting woman with a lot of interests that go in every direction. So it really does inform and affect her musicianship, but also her humanity, if I can say that. And it really comes through when she plays this all-encompassing experience. And when you talk to her, she's so down to earth, which is refreshing. But we're thrilled to have her here with the Arkansas Philharmonic.
I guess that leads into another question I had about you are conducting a lot of different symphonies and doing a lot of different projects, and Natasha's just flying in. How does that work? How do you get your mind into this one performance and sync yourself with the symphony and everyone play together to get it just right?
That's a terrific question. One of the greatest aspects of enjoyment, thrills, I guess I can say sometime, is trying to prepare for a performance with a soloist, especially if I've never worked together with them before. I have the great honor of working with Natasha about a year ago. But to look at a score, to try first and foremost to understand and try to realize with the orchestra what the composer's intent was, is a big task. But then taking the range of possibilities of tempo and phrasing and balance and the subtleties that might apply to a particular soloist mean that it's impossible to prepare exactly before the soloist arrives. So it's always a collaborative venture, which to me is one of the very greatest aspects of music. It's the spontaneity, it's the collaborative aspects. I know that some soloists, some conductors, some orchestra players like for things to be regimented and very clear that there's only one way this can go. But the extemporaneous, spontaneous nature of true collaboration is what I love most about music. And when you have world-class soloists like Natasha, it means that things from the rehearsals to the performance can change, but that they will be good because you know that the choices that they make will be appropriate. You know, the audience, the energy of the audience might change, so we might go a little slower, a little faster. It's just that real spontaneous collaborative aspect of performing that I love. And as long as we engage the right soloists who are interested in being that flexible, everything is always good.
Concert is Saturday night, Arendt Art Center.
At 7:30 p.m. And it's the kickoff to our new season. I think it's a fantastic concert. Berlioz to feature the entire orchestra, Brooke, this glorious concerto, and the Beethoven Symphony No. 5. It's just a dynamic beginning to the season and is representative of every concert that the Arkansas Philharmonic presents. And I'm very excited about it.
Well, break a baton, and you'll come back before the second.
I'll look forward to it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I talked with Stephen Bias, the conductor and musical director for the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra, earlier this week in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Katie Henriksen joined me in that conversation. Katie will be a daily part of KUAF's Monday through Friday schedule. Stay tuned for more information soon about that.
The Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra season opening concert features Max Bruch's violin concerto in G minor. As Ozarks at Large's Sophie Kidd tells us, the piece has a mercurial past.
That was the beginning of the Bruch Violin Concerto in G minor, Opus 26, one of the most performed and well-known violin concertos in the repertoire. Max Bruch was born in Germany in 1838 and was widely known and respected in his days as a conductor, a teacher, and a prolific composer who wrote over 200 works, including three violin concertos. The first one brought him his earliest and most enduring fame. He started having ideas for the piece in 1857 when he was a 19-year-old student, but the ideas came to fruition in 1865 at the beginning of his 2-year tenure as director of the Royal Institute for Music at Koblenz, a German city situated on both banks of the River Rhine. The concerto was his first large work for orchestra, and it was ready for performance by April 1866, with Otto von Königslow as soloist. After a public hearing, though, with Bruch himself conducting, he was convinced that repairs were needed, while he revised and refined it during the next year with the meticulous advice of the eminent Hungarian violinist Jozef Joachim, who was actually the one who provided similar assistance to Johannes Brahms with his violin concerto. Joachim was a soloist in the premiere, and Karl Martin Reithaler was the conductor of the definitive version of the concerto in 1868 in Bremen. In appreciation for his performance, he received the score's dedication. The concerto was an enormous hit, spreading Bruch's reputation across Europe and eventually worldwide. Unfortunately, the fate of this emotional and lyrical work is different. Bruch sold the score to a publisher for a small one-time payment. He also kept a copy of his own, but he never received another penny from its innumerable performances. After the end of World War I, he was desperate and unable to enforce the payment of royalties for his other works due to the chaos of worldwide economic conditions. In a poignant episode at the end of his life, he sent his autograph to the duo pianists from America, Rose and Ottilie Sutro, for whom he had written his concerto in A-flat minor for two pianos and orchestra, Opus 88A, in 1912. They were supposed to sell it in the U.S. and send him the money. Bruch died in 1920 without ever receiving any money. The Sutro sisters decided to keep the score themselves. Of course, they claimed that they sold it and sent Bruch's family some worthless German paper money as the alleged proceeds of the alleged sale. In 1949, they sold the autograph to Mary Flagler Carey, the heir of the Standard Oil fortune, and a notable philanthropist, whose collection, including the Bruch Concerto, now resides at the Pierpont Morgan Public Library in New York. Bruch was completely aware of the success that the concerto brought to him and his music, but he also came to realize that the work's exceptional popularity overshadowed his other pieces for violin and orchestra. Nothing compares to the laziness, stupidity, and dullness of many German violinists. That was his complaint to a publisher in a letter back from 1887. Every fortnight another one comes to me wanting to play the first concerto. I have now become rude and tell them, I cannot listen to this concerto anymore. Did I perhaps write just this one? Go away and play the other two concertos, which are just as good, if not better. Of course, his statements don't change anything. This concerto is a true showpiece for the master violinist. It possesses a solid musicianship and a memorable lyricism that make it a continuing favorite with both performers and audiences.
So Sophie Kidd is a musician, composer, and writer, and a regular contributor to Ozarks at Large.
It's Friday, October 28, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
And with us in the studio today is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. What's going on this weekend, Becca?
So do you think that we should dress up?
Yes.
And wander around all weekend? Because it is Halloween weekend.
I'm going to go as a zombie.
I mean, it's the one time that you can do that and not get a lot of eyebrows raised. If you've always wanted to dress like a pirate, you got a whole weekend now since Halloween's on Monday.
Well, actually, you know, I've been doing that for years, and I'm used to people raising their eyebrows because there will be folks this weekend at the Renaissance and Fantasy Fair of the Ozarks who aren't wearing costumes. They're wearing what we call garb. And it feels as natural as a T-shirt and a pair of jeans.
Let me ask you this. Let's say I go to this and I tell someone I like their costume. What will they say back to me?
Well, it depends on what kind of costume it is.
But you said it's called garb. Anyway, well, if I digress.
Okay, you digress. I'm talking about the folks who are in the Society for Creative Anachronism, and we don't think of them as costumes.
Gotcha.
You know, if you go up to a pirate wench and say, I like your costume, what she says is between you and her, and I'm not getting into that.
Okay.
There will be magicians. There will be belly dancers. There will be minstrels. There will be gypsies. There will be everything you can think of, including the local Grimfels group of the Society for Creative Anachronism. If you are one of those people who loves online gaming or you love movies like Thor and you'd like to go and find out the reality of playing in the Middle Ages, they'd be so happy to talk to you. They'd love to talk to you. They'll show you the musical instruments they make. They'll show you looms they make. They'll show you things they've woven and sewed. They'll show you armor they've made. And if you feel like hitting someone with a stick, they'll talk to you about how you can do that.
Where are they going to be?
The Fantasy Fair is at the Washington County Fairgrounds Arena in Fayetteville. And it's from 10 to dark on Saturday, 10 to 5 on Sunday. Admission is $5 for adults. Children younger than 12 are admitted free. And, you know, if you really don't care about recreating the Middle Ages, I'm almost sure there'll be turkey legs.
Fair enough.
You want some other things for the weekend?
Sure.
Please.
Sure.
Okay. How about theater? Because I always start with theater.
Mm-hmm.
Teenagers from Outer Space. The new Arts Live Theater show adapted from the 1959 film. I've got to get to this. 7 o'clock today, 2 Saturday, and 2 on Sunday at the theater in Fayetteville. Tickets are $4 to $6. I'm Sorry the Bridge Is Out. You'll Have to Spend the Night.
Halloween show.
Sounds scary.
It
last
is.
Weekend.
Well, it's funny.
7:30 today and tomorrow, 3 o'clock on Sunday. It's the last weekend at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. Tickets are $10 to $20. And West Side Story is this weekend, right around the corner from us at the Walton Arts Center. 8 o'clock today, 2 and 8 on Saturday, and 2 and 7 on Sunday. Tickets start at $49. Want some music?
Yes.
How about Meat Puppets?
Meat Puppets at George's?
Yes.
Fantastic.
10 o'clock today, hits like Backwater and Lake of Fire. This is a reunited band. And tickets are just $12.
Not bad.
Saturday, the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra, and I am excited because I got to talk to their guest violinist. Her name's Natasha Korsakova, fascinating girl. She will be performing with the orchestra in a concert called The Three Bees at 7:30 Saturday at the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. Tickets are $5 to $20. And Brian Adams is going to really play the show he was supposed to play on October 10th. He swears.
Okay.
Saturday night at the Fort Smith Convention Center. Tickets start at $35 at Ticketmaster, and tickets purchased for the previous date will be honored.
Oh, good.
We're not done yet. Can we keep going?
Keep going.
How about movies?
Sure.
Offshoot Film Festival is this weekend.
That's right.
Starts at 4:30 today, at 8 in the morning tomorrow, and at 11 in the morning on Sunday. Most of the events are at the University of Arkansas Global Campus Center. What do we used to call that?
Used to be called Center for Continuing Education.
Yeah, that place on the Fayetteville Square. It's $7 per show or workshop or $35 for the whole weekend. You can find out more at seedlingfilm.com. And then there's Halloween.
bringing us back to where we started, too much to list. You're going to have to go buy a copy of What's Up in today's paper because we've got a whole ton of stuff. Here's a few things. Voices from Eureka's Silent City. I want to go to this. Historic tours of the Eureka Springs Cemetery. Tonight and tomorrow night, tours start at 5:30. They leave every 20 minutes with the last one at 8. This is not a scare tour. This is a historical tour. Tickets are $10 for adults and $5 for children 12 and younger. Blood on the Border.
Fort Smith.
A creepy maze in the basement of the Fort Smith Museum of History.
Ooh.
Tickets are $5 and admission starts at 7 today through Monday. They're doing the Murder and Mayhem trolley again.
Which is fun.
But awesome. This year they're toasting the ghost. So they're going to have cocktails and hors d'oeuvres at the Fort Smith Museum of History and at various stops along the way. This is at 6:30 Saturday and Monday, and tickets are $25. You have to be 21 or older.
Okay.
Because they're toasting the ghost.
Oh, sure.
And in Fayetteville, Team Zombie will take on Team Vampire in a Northwest Arkansas roller derby bout at 6 o'clock Sunday at Starlight Stadium. Clearly, the skaters will be in costume. Tickets are $12 for adults, $5 for children ages 6 to 12. And the first 100 adult tickets sold online will be $10. So go to nwarollerderby.com or call 520-1117 and go scare someone.
That sounds like the pick of the weekend.
Doesn't it, though?
It does.
You got to love that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Becca. Becca Beckett-Martin is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So, Kyle, Halloween weekend?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Don't we have a giveaway?
We do. It's got a bit of a Halloween theme. First, let me tell you what our winners will receive, because we'll have three winners today.
Three winners.
And we have your Halloween weekend planned. Each winner will receive two tickets to the Arts Live Theater production of Teenagers from Outer Space. It opened last night, continues through the weekend, through Sunday afternoon. You'll also receive two movie passes to any Area Malco movie theater and two tickets to the Arkansas Philharmonic concert at Arend Arts Center Saturday night. Live theater.
Weekend.
Yes, it is. Live theater, cinema, live music. Here's the thing. These are all happening soon, so you'll need to be able to pick them up in person today. All right. It's Halloween weekend, as you mentioned. One of the most popular foods around Halloween, I don't know why, is candy corn.
Sugar?
Yes. In fact, sugar is the first ingredient listed on a package of candy corn. Today's trivia question, what's the second ingredient listed? Is it confectioner's glaze, honey, or corn syrup? 800-522-5823 to win this weekend package of tickets. 800-522-5823. Choices again, confectioner's glaze, honey, or corn syrup.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 28th of October, 2011. 1919, on this day, Congress overrode President Woodrow Wilson's veto and passed the Volstead Act, which provided for enforcement of the 18th Amendment to the Constitution prohibiting the sale of alcohol. The Prohibition movement, led largely by women who had a hard time making a living on their own, and many of them had seen their lives ruined when their husbands squandered the family income on alcohol. The law was not so enforced in big cities, and so prohibition was not so effective there. But in rural areas, it was. And when prohibition was in effect, death rates from cirrhosis of the liver fell by more than 50%, and admissions to state mental hospitals for alcoholism fell as well. It was on this day in 1886 the Statue of Liberty was officially unveiled and opened to the public. There was a big ceremony in front of the statue, which was under a veil. The sculptor Frederic Auguste Bartholdi was alone in the crown of the statue, waiting for the signal to drop the veil. A speaker was droning on, and Bartholdi mistook the signal, dropped the veil, and the speaker sat down. It's the birthday of Evelyn Waugh, born in London, 1903, author of Bride's Head Revisited and many other novels. And it's the birthday of the man who developed the polio vaccine, Dr. Jonas Salk, born in New York City, 1914. The vaccine released to the public in 1955 and the number of people infected by polio went down from more than 10,000 a year to less than 100. Here's a poem for today by Louise Glick, In the Plaza. For 2 weeks, he's been watching the same girl, someone he sees in the plaza, in her 20s maybe, drinking coffee in the afternoon, the little dark head bent over a magazine. He watches from across the square, pretending to be buying something, cigarettes, maybe a bouquet of flowers, because she doesn't know it exists. Her power is very great now, fused to the needs of his imagination. He is her prisoner. She says the words he gives her in a voice he imagines, low-pitched and soft, a voice from the South, as the dark hair must be from the South. Soon she will recognize him, then begin to expect him, and perhaps then every day her hair will be freshly washed. She will gaze outward across the plaza before looking down, and after that they will become lovers. But he hopes this will not happen immediately, since whatever power she exerts now over his body, over his emotions, she will have no power once she commits herself. She will withdraw into that private world of feeling women enter when they love. And living there, she will become like a person who casts no shadow, who is not present in the world. In that sense, so little use to him, it hardly matters whether she lives or dies. In the Plaza, by Louise Glick, from A Village Life, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, partners with the National Endowment for the Arts in Poetry Out Loud, a national poetry recitation contest for high school students. More information at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And time now for the answer to our question. Again, the three winners, we'll have three winners, receive a great weekend package, two tickets to the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra concert, the Three Bs. That's Saturday night at Arendt Arts Center in Bentonville. Two tickets to any area Malco movie theater, and two tickets to Teenagers from Outer Space Arts Live Theater. That takes place throughout this weekend. All right, the question was, what's the second ingredient? Because we know what the first ingredient in candy corn is.
Sugar.
Sugar. The question I asked, what's second? Is it confectioner's glaze, honey, or corn syrup? And during Garrison Keillor, you told me you knew the answer.
I did. And it is corn syrup.
Yes, most people did get that. Oh, if it were honey, that were the second ingredient, but it's not. So, as I mentioned, three winners will pick them out of the ceramic cow in just a few minutes. And then we'll call you and let you know if you're a winner. The Alma Performing Arts Center presents My Fair Lady Tuesday, November 8th at 7:30. This Broadway musical based on Shaw's play and Pascal's movie Pygmalion follows Henry Higgins as he falls in love with Eliza Doolittle. Tickets and more information are available at almapac.org or 632-2129.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Springdale, and Pawpaw.
You ever been to Pawpaw?
I have not.
Nor have I.
It's
I don't
west
think I
of
have.
Fort Smith.
Yes. All right. It's Halloween weekend. Please be safe. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.